All right, I believe those are the announcements. They will go right into the sermon. Now, I've given, I kind of mini-challenged those of you who are here last week to see if you could. I dropped some hints. We're in a multi-part series. For those of you who weren't here, we're starting a multi-part series, and it looks like it's going to be 3 weeks, based on what happened in Trenton this morning. It's almost certainly going to be 3 weeks, minimum. This is week two, and I gave a mini challenge to see if anybody could figure out who the silent hero of the story is. Well, you'll soon know if you guessed it right, because Mr. Johnsey and Mr. Schrock have a handout, and they're going to go around right now and give it to you. And as soon as you see the headline, you're going to know. No more secrets. So you could turn those out now. And one per adult. Now, don't jump up and down and squeal and say, "I got it." Wait till everybody has a chance to get their hand out. And if you did guess it in this last week, as I said, I promised, we will reward you. We'll give you an attaboy, an attagirl. We'll let you, maybe even let you raise your hand. Everybody can look at, see what talented, beautiful individuals you are if you guessed who this person was. Not one person guessed it in Trenton. Not surprising. So, while that is going around, let me just, for those of you who were not here, let me review what we did last week very briefly. This is a somewhat different approach I'm taking because I'm telling you the punchline before we even get into the story. And there are four primary lessons, I think, associated with the life of this silent hero in the Church of God, in the Church of God history or the Bible history. And those lessons we gave at the outset before we actually got into the story. Number one, even in the most horrible times you can imagine, even in the year 2018, it doesn't matter how awful the times are, even in frightening, chaotic, evil, horrible, ungodly times, it doesn't matter. There are always going to be, somewhere on the earth, largely unknown to most of the world, they're in the shadows, they're going to be silent heroes who serve the true God, a remnant. That's what God refers to as the remnant. It's a tiny, tiny handful compared to the world. But they are tuned in to the true God. That will always be the case. I just don't think you can read the Bible and find a place when time when that was never. Even when the world was about ready to be flooded because of universal sin, there was one family, Noah and his family, who found grace in the sight of the Lord. Did we have enough, Mr. Johnsey? We had enough? Okay. So, very good. Lesson number two, come out of her, my people. Unholy alliances. Unholy alliances. Between good and evil don't work. They just don't work in the long run. People try them. Even good people try them, and that's what we saw last week. And that's what we'll see again today. Maybe this is the exception. Maybe this is the exception where evil and righteousness can get along. Unholy alliances between good and evil do not work. Even though they seem to in the short run, they don't work in the long run, despite human reasoning. The third lesson is that even though blood is thicker than water, and even though most people say, well, that's family. I got to make allowances for family. When it comes to good and evil, even though blood is thick, it should not be so thick that we compromise. Even though blood is thicker than water, it often turns out to be a very gooey substance, that thick blood. We can get bogged down into it. It's a gooey, deadly basis when making big decisions in life. And the fourth lesson, no individual will succeed. Not with God, not in the long run, not in God's judgment. Nobody will succeed because of somebody else's righteousness, because of somebody else's character. Now, all four of those lessons come out in the lesson or in the story of this unlikely hero. His man named Jehoiada. And it'll even take us a good... Now, you can raise your hand if you guessed Jehoiada. I won't embarrass you too bad. Not one. Well, you're keeping up with Trenton. That's good. Jehoiada. I wonder if that name even rings a bell when I give you... He's kind of in the shadows. Maybe you remember vaguely hearing about Jehoiada, but probably not. A real hero. A real hero. And all four of those lessons are played out in the life of Jehoiada. But as I was about to say, it's going to take us a good long time, even today, in Sermon 2 of this series, even to get to him. He's kind of hidden, really in the dark shadows. But we have to lead up to seeing Jehoiada. Now, what I have given you looks like a mess. You know, there's a lot of material there on that one piece of paper. And yet, I'm going to walk through this. That'll be the structure of most of what we do today. We're going to walk through the handout. We'll turn to the scriptures. As I mentioned last week, that when you're focusing on a story of the kings of Israel or Judah, oftentimes you have to go back and forth between Chronicles and Kings, Kings and Chronicles, because part of the story is in one set of books and part in the other set of books. So it takes a while. It takes some turning back and forth. But let's not be intimidated by all the black on this piece of paper. It's almost more black than it is white. But let's start and notice that there's two sides to it. Good and evil. Righteousness and evil. For the most part, righteousness is going to be on the left side. And evil is going to be on the right side, for the most part. That's the way we've set this up. On the left side, under the header Jehoiada, the hero few people know about, you see, first of all, Judah on the left, Israel with its capital in Samaria on the right. All right, good on the left, relative good. Not as good as Jesus Christ, not perfection, but relatively speaking, good and righteous on the left. Relatively speaking, a lot of evil on the right. Now, we start out with two individuals whose names are more familiar to us than Jehoiada, and we saw these names last week in the lead-up to this. Jehoshaphat on the left, a righteous king in Judah, one of the several kings of Judah that was righteous. And on the right, we see King Ahab, very, very evil. Even though Jehoshaphat is basically a righteous man, he has a blemish or two. The Bible is kind of hard on its heroes, and in some cases, it's kind of easy on its villains. If a hero, if a righteous man made a mistake, oftentimes we're going to read about it in the Bible. It's just the way it is. Even Abraham, even David, even Moses, we even know of their failings, though they were certainly be in all three of those men will be in the first resurrection. They were great leaders of God. The same is true of Jehoshaphat. Basically a very righteous man, but one or two of his flaws, of his mistakes, are recorded for our admonition, so we can learn not to replicate his mistakes. So as I say under the heading there, King Jehoshaphat on the left side, basically a good king. Let's see the overall evaluation of him in that verse I put there on the handout. 1 Kings chapter 22. And I'll ask today, as I asked last week, how would you like these words written about you? If there was going to be a one-sentence summary of your life that God caused to be recorded in the Bible, what would you think if this were the sentence, or if this was the verse? I think you'd be pretty pleased with it. Let's look at it in 1 Kings chapter 22 and verse 43. You might even say it'd be hard to improve on this. This is about Jehoshaphat, overall evaluation of his life. He walked in all the ways of his father Asa. Asa was a righteous man. Asa emerged in last week's background sermon. He walked in all the ways of his father Asa. So he chose the right ancestor to emulate righteous Asa, his father. He did not turn aside from them. He was steadfast in doing the right thing, doing what was right in the eyes of the Eternal. That wouldn't be a bad sentence to be your biography, your one-sentence biography, or your one-verse biography. There is a however that immediately follows. He wasn't perfect, like Christ is perfect. There is a nevertheless, or a but. Nevertheless, here's a blemish on his record. It wasn't perfect. The high places, which were not taken away, for the people offered sacrifices and burnt incense on the high places. There was one place where sacrifices were to be offered, and that was at the temple in Jerusalem. That was it. There were to be no other places of worship or sacrifice. Now, in Abraham's time, okay, there wasn't a temple. In Job's time, perhaps the earliest book of the Bible ever written, okay. But once God established a liturgy, a formal worship system, one place, he didn't tear those down. He should have. All right, one blemish. You might say, boy, if that's the worst thing he ever did, pretty good, and I would agree. But there was a second blemish on his record. We'll see that in a minute. All right, now that's on the left side, the relatively good side, King Jehoshaphat. Let's go to the right side, King Ahab. Not much good you can say about Ahab, although, because the Bible is fair, there is one good thing you can say, one good thing you can say about Ahab. So we'll look at that in passing as well. But my summary there, and then we'll look at God's summary, he was a weak man. He was totally dominated by others, especially including his wife. He was a weak, wicked man. He was married to just about the most wicked woman the Bible records. I say just about because we're going to meet another one here in just a minute. But Jezebel was his wife. Now, Jezebel was not even an Israelite. Jezebel was a Phoenician. She was from the area up north of Israel, along the Mediterranean coast. Phoenicia, from the areas of Tyre and Sidon. Those were pagans. Those were not Israelites. So that was a pagan culture. She was a princess. She was the daughter of a king of the Phoenicians. And so already we see a problem. Here's Ahab, an Israelite, marrying outside the Israelite community. He married this woman, Jezebel, a wicked, murderous, intimidating, pagan woman. Not much good you can say about Jezebel. King Ahab already had permitted calf worship to continue. That's where the northern 10 tribes nation began, when they broke off from the temple area, from the United Monarchy, Saul, David, Solomon, Rehoboam, Jeroboam. Jeroboam split off, and the 10 tribes followed Jeroboam in rebellion. And they went up north and established their own kingdom, and he set up calf worship, 2 golden calves. That was still going on. That's bad enough. But his wife, Jezebel, brings her religion from Sidon, Baal worship. She introduced, and he led her, Baal worship into the northern kingdom. So now there's calf worship and Baal worship. He compounded the idolatry of the northern kingdom. Let's look at those verses I put there. 1 Kings 16. Not much good on the right side here so far under Ahab. 1 Kings 16. Let's look beginning in verse 30. Now Ahab, it tells us here, was the son of Omri. Omri was the first king in a dynasty. There were several dynasties up in Samaria, in the 10 tribes. In other words, a king, his son, his grandson, his great-grandson, several, and then the whole group would be disposed of and a new dynasty would begin, weren't even related to each other. There was only one dynasty down in the south by God's design. After Saul, there was one dynasty, the kingdom of Judah, David and his progeny. But there were multiple dynasties. Well, anyway, Omri was the head or the first king in this dynasty up north. And Ahab was the son. He was the first son of Omri. And he did evil in the sight of the Eternal. Look at that. More than all who were before him. More than Jeroboam. Jeroboam's the one who split off and set up the golden calf. Worse than that. Because now he's compounded it by adding Baal worship from his wife. And it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, which I just mentioned, the son of Nebat, calf worship, that he took his wife Jezebel. He married a Phoenician pagan Baal worshipping princess, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, Sidon. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him. And he set up an altar for Baal. He didn't just permit his wife to practice her religion. That would be bad enough. He promoted it. He even built a temple to Baal. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. And it's not good. In verse 33, Ahab made a wooden image. Ahab did more. Listen to this. How would you like this written about you? He did more to provoke the Eternal God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. That's not a good track record. Pretty much pure evil. Go forward a couple of chapters. 1 Kings 18, more of the story. Let's look at verse 17 through 19. So 1 Kings 18, verses 17 through 19. It happened when Ahab saw Elijah. So we talked about Elijah last week. Ahab interacted with Elijah, vice versa. Here's how he talked to God's prophet. Here was the quality of relationship with Elijah. It happened when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, to Elijah, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" Now how about that? Who is causing trouble and introducing sin and bringing God's wrath upon Israel? It's not Elijah. It's Ahab. I mean, you see this down through history. It almost seems like a law. The more evil somebody is, the more they blame other people of the very evil that they are practicing. They project their evil onto others. Boy, do we see that going on in the modern world, even in our land. A lot of projection, a lot of smoke. People who do things accuse their enemies of doing the same thing to get the spotlight off of themselves. That nothing new. This has been going on a long time. So he calls the prophet of God the one who's bringing trouble on Israel. Well, the prophet of God answered as he should have. He said, verse 18, "I've not troubled Israel. I'm not the one bringing God's wrath on Israel. You and your father's house have done that, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Eternal, and besides calf worship, you've introduced Baal worship, and you have followed the Baals," many gods in that system of religion. "Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal." We looked at a little bit of that story last week. Not seeing too much good there. Pretty evil. But the Bible is fair. It does tell us about the one time in Ahab's life that he did something right. One time, I don't know how long it lasted, he repented. Let's turn over to chapter 21. Even Ahab, what a story. Even he repented at least once, and it saved his life. It prolonged his life. You might remember from last week that one of the assignments that God gave to Elijah, he says, "You've got some unfinished business back up north. What are you doing down here on Mount Sinai in a cave?" One of his assignments was to go back and see to it that an assassin was ordained to do a lot of killing. It had come time in God's judgment for some people to lose their lives. Now, God could have struck them dead himself, but he decided to choose a human instrument, and that man's name was Jehu. And apparently one of the assignments of Jehu was to wipe out the entire dynasty of Omri, and now its head, Ahab. And that would have included Ahab. Jehu should have killed Ahab. He didn't, but he killed all the rest of the family. Why didn't he kill Ahab? Because of what we're about to read. Ahab prolonged his life by actually repenting at least once. And God granted him a little bit of additional life. This is 1 Kings 21, verse 27. After he's heard the judgment of God that's coming down upon him, 1 Kings 21, 27. "So it was when Ahab heard these words, he killed the prophet of God." No, that's what you'd expect to read, but he didn't. He actually didn't, amazingly. "He tore his clothes. He put sackcloth on his body. He fasted, and he lay in sackcloth and went about mourning." Didn't see that one coming. That's about as surprising as when Nineveh repented, when Jonah went there. Didn't really expect it. And God saw it. Verse 28, "The word of the Eternal came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying," look at that. It's almost like God was surprised. "Look at that, Elijah. See how Ahab has humbled himself before me. And because he has humbled himself before me, I'll not bring the calamity in his days." Hey, perhaps what he's saying is Jehu won't kill him. He'll kill everybody else. They didn't repent in the dynasty, in the family. But at least Ahab didn't die quite yet. Extended his life. "I'll not bring the calamity in his days, but in the days of his son I will bring the calamity on his house." Well, that happened. We'll read about it. Okay. Now, at this point, what I was hoping, and what you were probably hoping, is there would be a vertical line right down the top of the page all the way down to the bottom, and there would be nothing between the good and the evil side. There wouldn't be any cross-pollination. I wish there was a line there separating them. That's what it should be. It's not. Right in the middle is the story. Read it with me. During the reigns of Jehoshaphat, good, and Ahab, evil, there was an attempt to form an alliance, to get along, between Judah and Israel. This was the second blemish on Jehoshaphat's record. The other one was he didn't completely wipe out the other places of worship. He shouldn't have done that. He's still a righteous man overall, but he should not have done this. And we're going to see it has a lot of bad fruit that came as a result of it. During the reigns of Jehoshaphat and Ahab, there was an attempt to form an alliance between Judah and Israel, which was really a mixture, a fellowship of good and evil, relative good and relative evil. It wasn't righteous. Jehoshaphat should have stayed on the left side of the page. He didn't. Much of the rest of the stories, we'll see the fruits of that. It wasn't righteous before God. Let's look at 2 Chronicles. And a few of these verses that we look at today will be ones we also saw last week, but I'm emphasizing slightly different things. I'm showing you where King Jehoshaphat had this second blemish on his record. It was otherwise sterling. All right, 2 Chronicles 18 and verse 1. Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance, and by marriage he allied himself with Ahab. And boy, the red flashing light, the siren should be going off. That's a problem. That's 2 Chronicles 18 and verse 1. Didn't have to do it, but he did it. Big mistake. It says by marriage. We're going to see how that worked here in just a minute. It wasn't him marrying over on the right side. It was his son and a daughter from the right side. We go to chapter 19, verses 1 and 2. Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem. And here comes the assassin, Jehu, God's assassin. And he's out here and he's not happy because he has a message from God that God's not happy with Jehoshaphat. Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, "Should you help the wicked, house of Ahab, and love those who hate the Eternal? Therefore, the wrath of the Eternal is upon you." That's not what you would normally expect to hear about one of the most righteous kings who ever lived, especially in light of the overall evaluation we saw earlier. But in this instance, it was a big mistake. But was it a fatal mistake? Verse 3 says no. God's not happy with it, but he still is merciful. Nevertheless, even though you've made this major mistake, good things are found in you, in that you have removed the wooden images. He got rid of most of the idolatry. Not all of it. That was mistake number one, but he went most of the way. You have removed most the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek God. The other one I quote there, I think we read last time, the New Testament, 2 Corinthians 6:14, what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? That is a timeless truth, that is a timeless principle, and it has just been violated, and it is not going to produce good results. It didn't work. It produced all manner of death and evil for several generations. For several generations, we'll see the spinoff of that very bad mistake from righteous King Jehoshaphat. But it'll eventually take us into the shadows and we'll have the hero of our story emerge, Jehoiada. But it's going to take some searching to get there. All right, so that's Jehoshaphat, and that's the background. Right under that, we go back to left and right. Jehoshaphat, I repeat, on the left, shows you the years, the best evidence I could find of when he was on the throne of Judah, around the years 873 to 848 B.C. Now on the right, we go back and talk about Ahab a little bit more. And you can see the years he ruled up in Samaria were almost the same years. These are almost contemporaries, 874 approximately to 853 B.C. So there's a little summary under the word Ahab on the right of his family. We already know his father is Omri, the first king of the dynasty founded by him. 1 Kings 16:28. just reminds us of that. Read it to you here. 1 Kings 16, verse 28. Omri rested with his fathers and was buried in Samaria. Then Ahab, his son, reigned in his place. So Ahab is the son of Omri. He had a wife, Jezebel. Chapter 16, where we already are, verse 31. The same principle we've said Jehoshaphat violated by entering into an alliance with the right-hand side of the page, Ahab had already done. He'd gone clear outside the Israel community, and he'd married Jezebel, a princess from up in the pagan group in Sidon. But here in verse 31, it came to pass as though it had been a trivial thing. I read this earlier, but now we focus on his wife. For him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he took as his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Sidonians. She's a princess. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him because she brought Baal worship with her into that marriage. Right under that, you see he had a couple of sons. One was named Joram and one was named Ahaziah. And then he had a daughter. Her name is Athaliah. That's kind of a pretty name, don't you think? Athaliah, kind of a pretty name. When we read about Athaliah, you're not going to think anything pretty. I said earlier that Jezebel is just about the most wicked woman, maybe in all history, certainly in biblical history. You know who's given her a race, a run for her money? Her daughter, Athaliah. When you see what Athaliah did, kind of life she led, the influence she had, say, like mother Jezebel, like daughter Athaliah. Not a pretty picture. All right, let's go back over to the left-hand side. We had Jehoshaphat. I have a line coming down there that said he had a son. Read about that. 2 Chronicles chapter 21. So Jehoshaphat, the basically righteous man who has now made two mistakes we're aware of, one of them very serious. This is the details of that second mistake. But he has a son named either Joram or Jehoram. You see, I put the E-H there in little black brackets. Some places in the Bible, you'll read it Joram. Other places, referring to the same person, there's an extra vowel in there, Jehoram. So you see it both places. That's another thing. When you're going through Kings and Chronicles, it can be confusing. Because you see different spellings of the name of the same person. It can be a little bit confusing. But he's called Joram or Jehoram. This is a son of Jehoshaphat. 2 Chronicles 21. And verse 1. Jehoshaphat rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Then Jehoram, his son, reigned in his stead. Not much good you can say about this man, Joram. I just put a couple of them out there. That's not all the bad he did. Look what I say there. We'll read the scriptures. He killed all his brothers. Who does that? He killed all of his brothers. His father, Jehoshaphat, had many sons. Joram is the new king when Jehoshaphat dies. Why would he kill all of his brothers? Well, the simple answer is he's evil. But a second answer is he didn't want to be looking over his shoulders because they want to be king maybe. Maybe they're evil too. They're also sons of the king. As long as they're around, one slip up and he's out. His brother, another son of the previous king, gets to be king. So one way around that problem is kill them. And he did. He killed all of his brothers. Anybody else who could have a claim to the throne, going back to David. 2 Chronicles 21, we read that. We were already there. When Jehoram was established over the kingdom of his father, he strengthened himself. He killed all his brothers with the sword and also others of the princes of Israel. Cousins, uncle, anybody who would have said, I'm related through Jehoshaphat back to David. I got a Y chromosome, and I can trace myself back to David. He killed them all. Many as he could, he killed them. But he did also something else very bad. And, you know, we could debate, did he do this? And his daddy, Jehoshaphat, said, okay, I'll let you. Or did his daddy arrange the marriage? This is where Jehoshaphat made his mistake. He arranged for his son Jehoram to marry over on the right side of the page. He was married to Athaliah, the daughter of Jezebel. 2 Kings chapter 8. He didn't marry well. 2 Kings chapter 8. Maybe the reason he was so evil, or part of the reason he was so evil and killed all his brothers, is because he was influenced by his wife, Athaliah, the daughter of Jezebel and Ahab. But regardless of the cause, these are the things he did. These were the decisions he made. He married Athaliah, 2 Kings 8, beginning in verse 16. Now, in the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab... Oh, now that gets confusing. I thought we were talking about Joram, the son of Jehoshaphat. This is Joram, the son of Ahab. Yeah, that's right. Once they started intermarrying, they started using each other's names. So we'll name this baby after his brother, his uncle over there on the other side. They started sharing the same name. That's another reason when you're reading through these books of Kings and Chronicles, it can get a little bit confusing. In fact, if you look over there again under Ahab, he's got a son named Joram. I put a little one, Joram. That's the first Joram. Now over here on the left, the son of Jehoshaphat, the man we're focusing on, he's also Joram. He's Joram the second. Those are brothers-in-law. The Joram on the left side is married to the sister of the Joram on the right side. And there's also an Ahaziah on the right side under Ahab. Well, you'll find an Ahaziah is the son of Joram. So nephew and uncle have the same. It gets a little confusing. So that's why we're taking the time to go over this. This is an incestuous mixing of righteousness and evil. It's not going to produce good fruit. So right, he marries Athaliah, 2 Kings 8, verse 16. It says, in the fifth year of Joram, that's the one over on the right side, Joram the son of Ahab, the king of Israel, Jehoshaphat having been king of Judah, Jehoram, that's the one on the left side, the son of Jehoshaphat, began to reign as the king of Judah. He was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years. That's not very long. Why did he only last 8 years? Because he was so evil, God cut his life short. He had an evil wife. He entered into an evil mixture with the right-hand side. He's the son of a good man. But one of his father's big mistakes was either letting or causing him to marry on the right side. He became so evil that God cut his life short. Not in a pleasant way either. Quite a story. So that was 16, 17, 18. He was 32 years old when he became king, verse 17. He reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. He walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Well, it's not a surprise. He married into the family of the kings of Israel. He married a daughter of Jezebel and Ahab, just as the house of Ahab. Yeah, he married into that family, had done. For the daughter of Ahab was his wife. Yeah, Athaliah. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. We'll see some of the evil he did. One is, we already know, he killed all his brothers. Let's go also to verse 26. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king. He reigned 1 year. Okay, now that's his son. We'll get to that here in a minute. So that's the next generation. But there's something I want to stop and get you to focus on here. What is God's promise? That there would always be a son, a male descendant of, at least in biblical times, it would be a male descendant of David. All right? What happens when Jehoram or Joram on the left side kills all his brothers? He's the last link in the chain. I said that the hero of this story is in the shadows, Jehoiada. We've got to keep going in the story before we can get deep enough in the shadows to find Jehoiada. But there's another couple of individuals in this story. They're behind the scenes. One of them is Satan the devil. He would like nothing more than to blow up the plan of God by causing the prophecies of God to fail, by causing the promise that there would always be a male descendant of David to be on the throne, and Jesus would be born and sit on the throne of his father David. If he could see to it, if Satan could see to it, there was no male heir, no male seed, the seed of promise, that he could blow up the plan of God. So he thinks. So Satan's behind the scene, and at this point he's down to one man. If Satan could cause Joram, because he has no brothers, to die, that would be a failure of the prophecy. Let's look at those prophecies. We'll come back. This is a detour, but just to focus our mind on that. Here's the promise, 2 Samuel 7. So behind the scene of this story, there is another dynamic going on. Will Satan be successful in blowing up the plan of God, causing the promises and the prophecies of God to fail? Here's the promise, 2 Samuel 7, back in the time of David, verse 16. I'm in 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel 7 and verse 16. Your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. Now, there would be occasions when, in the time of Jeremiah, perhaps it was only female descendants of David, the royal seed. But down through the, down into the time of Jesus, there is a male succession that is shown in the books of Luke and Matthew. Jesus was the son of Joseph, was the son of, it goes all the way back to David. It goes even further. Satan would have loved dearly to have broken that string. And we're on the last link in the chain with Joram. Keep that thought in mind. So there's 2 Samuel 7:16. Now let's go to Isaiah chapter 11. This is probably a chapter that will be read almost certainly at the Feast of Tabernacles. Isaiah chapter 11. More about the house of David, the lineage of David, the throne of David, an unbroken string down to Christ. There shall come forth a rod, Isaiah 11 verse 1, from the stem of Jesse. That's David. A branch shall grow out of his roots. Jesus, the branch, would grow out of the lineage of David. How's that going to happen if it's wiped out? A branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, of knowledge and of the fear of the Eternal, a prophecy of Christ. His delight is in the fear of the Eternal, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. How can he come from David's lineage if David's lineage has died out? Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 5. Again, a prophecy of Jesus, who will be a descendant of David. Well, if there are no remaining living descendants of David, how will this be possible? That's the way Satan thinks. And so he would do all that he could to see that there are no living descendants of David. All right, so Jeremiah 23 and verse 5. Behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal, that I will raise to David a branch of righteousness. And a king shall reign and prosper and execute judgment and righteousness in the earth. In his days Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell safely. Of course, we believe there is still a descendant of David sitting on the throne of David in Westminster. In this case, it's a woman. And Luke, when it's talking about Christ, Luke chapter 1. Verse 32. He will be great. This is a prophecy of Jesus at the time of his birth. Luke 1 and verse 32. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God will give him the throne of his father David. So he has to be a descendant of David. Or if there's no descendants of David, that can't be true. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. If there's one thing you can say about Satan, he's consistent. He never gives up. We go to Revelation chapter 12. And here is a description of another attempt. Let alone back in the times of Joram and Ahaziah and Joash, as we're going to get back to in a minute, but in the time of Jesus' birth. there was Satan trying to destroy the promised seed. Revelation chapter 12, verse 1, a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. Now, symbolically, this could represent Israel giving birth to the kingdom of God, spiritual Israel, yes, but literally Mary, the mother of Jesus. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon. Wherever you find the promised seed, especially the salvation seed, David unto Christ and so on, that chain, you're not going to find Satan very far away. And especially when it's reduced down to a single link, that if that link were broken, the whole thing would fall apart. Satan's going to be around causing trouble, or trying to. So here's the fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. And of course, we know the story of Jesus' birth and Herod. So again, when the prophecies of God, the plan of God is kind of down to a single link and it's on the line, Satan's not going to be very far away trying to destroy it and cause it to fail. All right, we go back to the handout then. So we, on the left side, we're looking at this Joram or Jehoram. He's a wicked man. He's married to a wicked woman. He killed all his brothers. Now, he didn't last very long. I'm going to get back to that. His evil was so great that God got involved in ending his life. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 21. Now, he's the last link in the chain. And he's not going to last very long, but we'll see that Satan was not successful. If Jehoram dies right now, you've got a failed prophecy. But let's look at some of his character, how different he was from Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was almost totally good with a couple of mistakes. This man's almost totally evil. I don't see much good he does. 2 Chronicles 21. So who are we going to blame for this? Ultimately him. It looks like his father Jehoshaphat made a mistake in either allowing him or causing him to marry Athaliah, but still he gave in to that evil. It became his character. 2 Chronicles 21, beginning in verse 15. This is God's judgment on this man, this Joram or Jehoram. You will become very sick with the disease of your intestines come out by reason of the sickness day by day. Moreover, the Lord stirred up against Jehoram the spirit of the Philistines. So he's sick. God's judgment is upon him. He eventually dies of this disease, of this sickness. And besides that, he now has warfare at his borders from the Philistines, as if God had taken away any protection from this man at all. So the Lord stirred up against Jehoram the spirit of the Philistines and the Arabians who were near the Ethiopians. Now look at what follows here. And they came, these enemies, came into the land of Israel, into Judah. They came into Judah and invaded it and carried away all the possessions that were found in the king's house and also his sons. Now wait a minute. If Satan can use the Philistines to kill all the sons of Joram, then again, the prophecies fail. The plan of God is on the line here. And you got an enemy army. They're in the nursery. They've got all the kids. Or do they? Do we see somebody else behind the scenes here? They found in the king, and also his sons and his wives, so that there was not a son left to him. If there's a period right there, the plan of God just blew up. But it's not a period. It says, except. Except Jehoahaz, the youngest of his sons. Somehow, one son is saved. Now, in my handout, under Jehoram, I've got son, Ahaziah. It's the same person. Sometimes in the Bible, the same man has several names. Like most of you have a first name and a middle name. Maybe you have two middle names. This particular man, we just read that in 2 Chronicles, he's called Jehoahaz. He's also called Azariah, but he's also called Ahaziah. It's all the same person. So I wrote it down, Ahaziah, with a little 2 superscript. He's named after his uncle, Ahaziah, over on the other side. One of the other sons of Ahab was Ahaziah. Well, this boy over in the Judah side, once this mixing, this attempt to form an alliance, we've got a lot of cross-naming going on. Ahaziah, he only lasted 1 year. He only lasted 1 year. But before he died, he had many sons. So follow his name down. Under Ahaziah, also called Jehoahaz and Azariah, many sons, one of whom is named Joash. And we'll come back to that. But now let's go back up to Ahaziah and learn a little bit about him. He entered into an alliance against the nation of Syria. He entered into a military alliance with his uncle over on the right side. So this mistake that Jehoshaphat had made with Ahab is now carrying on. The same kind of mistake is carrying on to the second and the third generation. And it never is going to produce good results. This Ahaziah entered into an alliance with his uncle over on the right side. The Joram on the right side, his uncle. He didn't last very long. He lasted 1 year. Why did he only last 1 year? Remember the assassin? The assassin got him. Jehu got him. Wait a minute. I thought Jehu's job was to kill all the house of Ahab on the right side. Well, it was. But now that house has trickled over and there's been intermarriage. And this wicked Ahaziah on the left side is also killed by Jehu. Jehu was very thorough. When he was commissioned by God to kill the bad guys, he went after all of them on both sides of the page. 2 Kings chapter 9. This is a pretty bloody story, but, you know, there's lessons in it. Good does not come from unholy alliances. 2 Kings 9. We'll start in verse 16. Jehu, God's assassin, appointed, or was supposed to be appointed by the prophet Elijah, that we read about last week. Jehu rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel. That was the capital, or that was the palace up there in the north. For Joram was laid up there. Joram, the king of Israel, on the right side. And Ahaziah, his nephew, the one we're looking at on the left side. They had entered into alliance. They'd fought a battle. Joram, his uncle Joram, had gotten wounded. Well, Jehu's going to hunt him down and kill him. And now Ahaziah's over here on the left side. And Ahaziah, the king of Judah, had come down to see Joram. So Ahaziah, the son of Joram on the left, and Joram on the right, the son of Ahab. Now a watchman stood on the tower in Jezreel, and he saw the company of Jehu as he came and said, I see a company of men. And Joram said, get a horseman and send him to meet them, and let him say, is it peace? Well, if Jehu is coming at you full speed, he doesn't have peace on his mind. He's got his job on his mind, which is to kill you. And we can read that. Let's go to verse 24. Jehu drew his bow with full strength, and he shot Joram between his arms. That's the Joram on the right, the Israel king, the uncle of the man we're looking at. And the arrow came out at his heart, and he sank down in his chariot. Then Jehu said to Bidkar, his captain, pick him up and throw him into the tract of the field of Naboth, the Jezreelite. Well, that may ring a bell. That was the poor man whose property was stolen by Ahab, because he wanted all the surrounding land. And so now here a generation later, God's justice falls on Joram. For remember, when you and I were riding together behind Ahab, his father, the Lord laid this burden on us, upon him. Surely I saw yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, says the Lord, and I will repay you in this plot, says the Lord. Now therefore take and throw him on the plot of ground according to the word of the Lord. But when Ahaziah, that's the guy we're looking at here, with three names on the left side. When Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this, he fled. He tried to get away from Jehu. Read the rest of the story. He didn't make it. Jehu got him as well. And he'd only been the king on the left side here for a very short period of time, 1 year. All right. So Ahaziah doesn't last very long. He was the one remaining link. And now he has many sons. Go down to Joash there on the left side. Many sons. Joash survives by a miracle, but all the rest are murdered by somebody. There's a lot of killing going on in these families. Who do you suppose murdered all the sons of Ahaziah except one? Their grandmother. I told you she was evil. Athaliah. She's killing all of her grandchildren, all of her grandsons. Why? So she can be the queen. Like mother, Jezebel, like daughter. She's power hungry. She's murderous. What a story. What a story. So Joash, little baby Joash, is the only one of her grandsons that this evil woman, Athaliah, doesn't kill. Now, she thought she got them all. Once again, if all the sons of Ahaziah are killed, well, that's the third time now. It's the last link in the chain of David. And she, being inspired by Satan and the influence and the example of her mother, is trying to do precisely that. She tried to kill all of them, and she got all of them, but she missed one. He was just a baby. The baby was rescued. The baby was rescued by the baby's aunt and uncle, and we finally found the hero. It's the uncle. Let's read some of that. Second Kings 11. Now this Athaliah, she's already lost her husband, Joram. She's already lost her son, Ahaziah. And now she wants to kill all of her grandchildren, Ahaziah's sons, so that she can be the queen. And for 6 years she got away with it. Because for 6 years she thought she got them all. Chapter 11 of 2 Kings, verse 1. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal heirs. All her grandsons, she thought. But somebody named Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, the sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away. I mean, you almost get a picture. There's a nursery or a kindergarten or a private school, the royal private school, and all the sons are there of Ahaziah. And Athaliah sends her henchmen, her assassins in there to kill all her grandsons. And while they're doing that, their aunt, this woman who's a half-sister of Ahaziah, her name is Jehosheba. She is a son of Joram, but she's not mentioned as the daughter of Athaliah. I mean, she's probably a half-sister to Ahaziah. Joram probably had multiple wives. Most of the kings did. So she's a sister of Ahaziah, but she's not the daughter of Athaliah, because Joram probably had another wife, maybe multiple other wives. She's at least a half-sister. So she's a half-sister of the dead king whose children are being assassinated by the grandmother. And she steals this little baby named Joash out of harm's way. And she happens to be married to the hero of our story, who up until now has been in the shadows, the high priest. This is a rather unusual marriage. We've seen a lot of unusual things. This woman who saved her nephew, Joash, saved the seed of David. She is of royal parentage, but she's married to the high priest. Very rarely would those two families intermarry, the royal family and the priestly. But she is. She's married to the high priest, who is Jehoiada. And at this point, he emerges from the shadows to become the hero of our story. He knew and served the true God in the midst of all this chaos and evil and killing and chicanery. He emerges, he and his wife, to keep the plan of God on track. Let's put it this way. God used them to keep the plan of God on track. So I'm starting to read there. When Athaliah, this is 2 Kings 11, verse 1, the mother of Ahaziah saw that her son was dead. She rose and destroyed all the royal heirs. But Jehosheba, half-sister to the dead king, the daughter of King Joram. Doesn't say she's the daughter of Athaliah, so it probably has a different mother. The daughter of King Joram, the sister of Ahaziah, at least the half-sister, took Joash, little baby Joash, the last link in the chain, the son of Ahaziah, stole him away from among the king's sons who were being murdered. What a scene you could put together in your mind. And they hid him and his nurse in the bedroom from Athaliah so that he was not killed. He was hidden with her in the house of the Lord. How do you get there? How could she take this baby and house him and hide him in the temple? Because she happens to be married to the high priest. She's married to the high priest. She has access to the secret chambers of the temple complex. And they hid this baby for 6 years in the temple, in a bedroom in the temple. A lot of side rooms in the temple. And after 6 years, this is a coup, but it's not really a coup. It's putting Joash, who belonged on the throne, back on the throne. And Uncle Jehoiada, the real hero of the story, and his wife Jehoshabeth, the aunt of the little boy, they engineer a coup to put Joash on the throne. They put Joash on the throne. And as long as Jehoiada is still alive, he exerts a positive and a righteous influence on Joash. Joash is a weak-charactered individual. But as long as his uncle, the high priest Jehoiada, and his aunt Jehoshabeth are around, they exert a positive, righteous influence on him, and he does good things. But remember one of the other lessons from last week? Nobody will succeed in the judgment of God in the long run based on somebody else's righteousness. Joash, you can only lean on Uncle Jehoiada so long. But eventually you've got to make righteous decisions yourself. So you look at the little summary down here at the bottom. Saved from death. This is the last paragraph on your handout. Saved from death by his aunt Jehoshabeth and Uncle Jehoiada. And we read there. We read it in 2 Kings 11. You also see it in 2 Chronicles 22. Thus preserving the seed of David. That's the third time it was down to one male descendant. Each time it was preserved. Joash, at the time, was the only surviving direct male descendant of David. Joash had sons. So he grows up. He's put back on the throne. He does good things for most of his life, as long as his uncle, his righteous uncle, is there to guide him. And he has sons. So the throne of David and the seed of David is maintained. It's not here on my handout, but even Joash, I mean, he had a son named Amaziah. Well, I'll just read that to you. To kind of finish the story, I didn't have room on the paper here for it, but 2 Kings 12, after three times where it's down to one male descendant, Joash has multiple sons, and that crisis kind of ends. I'll tell you why this crisis ends, because the family of Ahab is wiped out by Jehu. We haven't really got to the details of that, but that's the cause of much of this, and intermarrying with them and making an alliance with them. But over here in 2 Kings chapter 12, we'll see sort of the end of the story as it emerges on the other side of Joash. 2 Kings 12, verse 21. Now, let's actually start in verse 19. Joash, now this is fast forwarding. This little baby has grown up. He's been influenced righteously by his uncle. That's part of the story. And it says, now the rest of the acts of Joash. This is 2 Kings 12, 19. The rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? And his servants arose and made a conspiracy, and they killed him. So he was assassinated by his own inner council. There's more to that story. But did he have a son? Did he have somebody with David's DNA that took over after him? For Jozachar, the son of Shimeath, and Jehozabad, the son of Shomer, his servants, struck him. So he died, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David. Then Amaziah, his son, reigned in his place. Whew. Now we got another descendant of David, and that goes on. But three times, with Joram, with Ahaziah, and with Joash, it was down to the last male descendant. But we want to see what Joash did. Did he live a righteous life? I said he did for a while. But he was apparently weak character, easily led. He was led by his righteous uncle, but when his righteous uncle wasn't there anymore. Joash turned very evil in his latter days. He ended up getting assassinated. 2 Chronicles 24. How evil did he become? There's hardly any happy endings in this story other than the plan of God was preserved. The seed of David was preserved three times, I think miraculously, when it was down to the last link. But going clear back to the original mistake of Jehoshaphat letting his son intermarry with Ahab, there's not much good about this story. And Joash's life doesn't end well. 2 Chronicles 24, beginning in verse 20. The Spirit of God came upon Zechariah. Now see, Zechariah, that's a familiar name. There's a book of the Bible named Zechariah, one of the minor prophets, Zechariah. But there's also this man, Zechariah. What happened to this man? Let's read it. The Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada. See, Jehoiada wasn't around forever. He eventually did die. God gave him a very long life. He gave him a very long life to righteously influence his nephew Joash. But eventually that very long life came to an end. He actually lived 130 years. From the time of Moses, nobody lived in the Bible. It's recorded as living as long as this Jehoiada, our hero. Our hero in the shadows. But he eventually died. And now there's a new high priest, Zechariah. Now it says the son of Jehoiada. Sometimes in the Bible, son could mean grandson. He's a descendant of Zechariah. The reason I make that point will be obvious here in a second. So the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah. He's a descendant in some way. He's a son in some generation of Jehoiada, our silent hero, who preserved Joash, had a right influence on him. The priest who stood above the people and said to them, thus says God, why do you transgress the commandments of the Eternal? So now this Zechariah, a son or grandson of Jehoiada, is witnessing to the people and to Joash, who he had saved when he was a baby, or his father or grandfather had saved when he was a baby. And he says, you're going right back into sin because you have forsaken the Eternal. Because of that, he has forsaken you. Well, people don't like to be told that. That God's angry with them because they've disobeyed God. So they were enraged. The people under Joash were enraged. What did they do? Verse 21. They conspired against him. And at the commandment of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the Eternal. So here's a man named Zechariah, a prophet of God, a descendant of a high priest, killed in the temple area for saying God's witness. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which Jehoiada his father, the ancestor of this man he just had killed, had done to him. But he killed his son or his grandson. Does that name Zechariah ring any kind of a bell? Jesus talked about kind of the beginning and the end of the story of righteous people being killed by unrighteous people. Who was the first righteous person killed by an unrighteous person? Abel was killed by Cain. And Jesus commented on it. And who was the last one Jesus talked about? Let's read it. If I can find it in my notes. I know I wrote it here. Okay. Matthew 23. Let's turn over there. What is it, about 6 o'clock? Not quite. We're almost through. Matthew 23. We're almost through for today. Matthew 23. Now, this is something Jesus said, kind of giving a summary of history. Righteous people being killed by wicked people. That on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah. It says the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Now, we just read about a man named Zechariah who was murdered at the temple. But that says his father was Berechiah. Over here it says his father was the hero of our story, Jehoiada. There'd be a very easy way to reconcile that and make this the same person. Jehoiada lived to be 130 years old. By the time he died, he's got old sons and old grandsons. The missing generation in between might have been that Berechiah, his son, who might have died before he did. So Jehoiada lived so long, maybe his son Berechiah dies before he did, and then his grandson Zechariah takes over as the high priest. So that would reconcile these two accounts, if in fact this is the same Zechariah. But by the time you get to 2 Chronicles, you're kind of near the end of the story of the Old Testament. And Jesus was giving the beginning and the end of the Old Testament history, from Abel to Zechariah. Now, some people would say the Zechariah Jesus was talking about was the prophet Zechariah. Could be, but it also could be this with that little comment. But as long as Jehoiada is around, things go pretty well. But what about when he's no longer around? They don't go so well. 2 Chronicles 24, verse 21. I'm sorry, 2 Chronicles 24, verse 1. Joash was 7 years old. Okay, he was a year old baby when his righteous uncle and aunt rescued him from his grandmother. Joash was 7 years old when he became king. So 6 years, evil Queen Athaliah got to be the queen, and then she was overthrown. We didn't actually get into the details of that, but it happened. He's 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zebiah of Beersheba. Joash did what was right in the sight of the Eternal. I wish there were a period right there. There's not. He says he did right in the eyes of the Eternal all the days of Jehoiada the priest, his uncle, when he was along there to influence him. Jehoiada took for him two wives, and he had sons and daughters. It happened after this that Joash set his heart on repairing the house of the Eternal. That's good. But once Jehoiada died, it fell apart. It fell apart badly. Verse 15 of that same chapter. Jehoiada grew old, was full of days. He died. He was 130 years old. Again, nobody since Moses had lived that long. That's even 10 years longer than Moses. And then verse 17. This is a sad ending to the story of Joash. After the death of Jehoiada, his righteous uncle, the hero of the story, working in the shadows, the leaders of Judah came and they bowed down to the king. They played politics, and the king listened to them. Therefore, they left the house of the Eternal God of their fathers. They went right back into paganism. So did Joash. He ended up being assassinated. Now, all of that on that handout, I hope it's at least a little bit helpful, because there's multiple people with the same names and different spellings. Now we have a pretty good handle on the story, but we've been jumping all around. So I want to take one more part next week, and we're going to actually read the story. We're just going to start and then read it smooth, because we have the background. We won't have to do all the jumping around, and I think we'll see some additional details that might prove beneficial.